The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Catherine Pompilio with an episode of Chatter for June 5th, 2022. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Chatter, a podcast hosted by David Priest and Shane Harris that features in-depth discussions with fascinating people at the creative edges of national security. Today's Chatter episode is entitled The Secrets of Gay Washington with Jamie Kirchick. In the episode, Harris sat down with Kirchick to discuss the secret history of gays and lesbians in the Capitol, as well as the history of secrecy in which they played pivotal roles. This is Chatter.
This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, author Jamie Kirchick on the secret history of gay Washington.
We learn a lot about each president through their relationship to this issue of homosexuality. One of the first executive orders that Eisenhower signs is 10450, which bars gay people from working for the federal government, but more importantly, at least in terms of this conversation, is it denies them security clearances. It basically makes it very difficult for a gay person to advance at all in this city. One of the things I learned in this book was that a stereotypical gay male activity was antique collecting. So they would say that he enjoys collecting antiques, and that was sort of a wink and a nod.
Jamie Kirchick, welcome to Chatter. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Shane.
We were going to be in person, but God's wrath opened up on this gay, sinful city of Washington and has exiled us to be on Zencastr. But it's good to see you. How are you feeling? You just birthed five babies with this giant, amazing book, Secret City. How are you feeling about it?
I'm feeling very excited. You spend so much time working on something and you really want to share it far and wide.
Yeah.
As many people as possible. So I appreciate your taking the time. And one of the major themes of this book is espionage. And so I knew,
yes.
I knew that you would be someone I had to go to with it. So
you were right. And that is one of the big themes we're going to talk about. And you actually have a whole wonderful kind of thesis of the book, or maybe one of many, but it's like the notion that in the secret world of espionage and in Washington, in which secrecy is currency and you derive power from it, there are so many interesting stories to tell about gay men and lesbians who have to themselves have had to live secret lives. Mm. And that's just a wonderful kind of parallel and becomes such a critical part of the story. And we'll get into many of those great spy stories. But first, you've been working on this book a long time. I've known you for years, I should say, for much of the time that I've been in Washington. And we have a lot of, friends in common. And you've been working on this book for a long time. I remember when you first, I feel like it was many years ago when I learned that you were going to tackle this and thinking, you said you're going to write a gay history of Washington and thinking God, that's great. Somebody should do that. Mm. And now here it is. So talk about the genesis of this book.
So I think it was sort of subconsciously planted when I was actually a student at Yale. And, Cold War history is really my passion. And just the Cold War as a epoch has always fascinated me. all details of it, you know, and all aspects of it. Like, I love, you know, spy movies. Mm-hmm. My favorite movie is The Lives of Others, you know,
that's such a great movie.
Yeah. I worked for Radio Free Europe, which is one of the great sort of legacy Cold War institutions. I lived in Berlin, which was the center of the Cold War. So it's just kind of my bag. Mm-hmm. But at Yale, one of my professors there was John Lewis Gaddis, who's the real dean of Cold War history, and also George Kennan's biographer. And he was my academic advisor, and he was teaching a seminar on the art of biography, mm-hmm. on how to write biographies. And we would read a biography every week in class, and then the final term paper had to be our own biography of anyone living or dead whose papers were at Yale. And I was very lucky in that Larry Kramer, the great rabble-rousing ACT-UP activist and playwright, and famously a Yale graduate, he had just donated his papers to Yale. And so I chose Larry, and I started working through his papers and went down to New York and interviewed him and got to know him quite well. And that was kind of like a maybe like a foreshadowing, a sort of a merging of these two intellectual interests of mine of, you know, Cold War, American political history, foreign policy, Cold War foreign policy, history, all that, with gay history, mm-hmm. and the role of gay people in history. And Larry was, a very outspoken individual, and we would keep in touch, and I would come visit him, and he would always, you know, I'd send him my articles, what I was writing, what I was doing in Washington, because I graduated college and went to work at the New Republic magazine. And Larry was insistent, being, why are you writing about anything else but gay people? This is, this is when gay marriage was still being debated. And he was just insistent about this. And he was also very insistent about the importance of gay history. There was a academic program at Yale that his brother had donated the money for that was named after him. It was meant to be a gay history initiative. It ended up being a sort of queer theory initiative, and that's a whole nother story. And Larry got into massive fights with the university, but he was very passionate about gay history and why it should be studied. And I think him, you know, needling me for years and years basically got me to sort of realize, hey, you know what? There's a book here.
Yeah,
and all these phenomena, all these presidencies and eras and aspects of American history that we all think we know, there's sort of a hidden gay element to them, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's McCarthyism, whether it's the Reagans, whether it's the Kennedys, whether it's the OSS, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, it's just this kind of omnipresent subject that's lurking there in the shadows. And no one had put it all together. You know, there was one book on the Lavender Scare, which was the period in the 1950s when gay people were purged from government. But it's a fine book, but it's a short academic book. There had been no sort of all encompassing look into this subject that would try to tie everything together into one book. And so I decided to do it. And here it is.
And I think what gives this book, I mean, even a, you know, I described it and it's, you know, it's on the cover. It says The Hidden History of Gay Washington. Of course, you're right there. You are writing about elements of history in the city of Washington about gay people. But this, the ambition of this is a national history. We're talking about Washington through the national lens.
Yeah.
And, you know, how you did something which I thought was really smart and helpful for the reader, which is that you break it up into chapters by presidencies.
Yeah.
And so you're viewing it as, you know, a series of administrations. Talk about that a little bit, because I thought, you know, there were so many ways you could construct a narrative out of this, but to just break it by chapters by the president. Why did you decide to do it that way?
Well, I think for better or worse, we as Americans understand our history or our political history through the presidencies, right? So there's the FDR.
I agree with that.
Yeah, there's the FDR era, there's the Eisenhower era, there's Kennedy and Camelot, there's the Nixon, and that's just how we do it. And I'm sure there are historians who might not like that and say that it's all wrong. But in trying to write a book for a popular audience, right, this is a book that I want anyone who's interested in politics, American history, espionage, I want that general reader, you know, straight or gay. I think, I don't think you have to be gay to be interested in this.
No, not at all. Yeah.
So I was writing for that audience. And I also think we learn a lot about each president through their relationship to this issue of homosexuality, right? Like, I think we learn something about FDR's character in the way that he deals with the tragedy of Sumner Wells, who was his undersecretary of state, who was gay and his career was destroyed over it. I think we learn something about FDR and how he handles it. I think we learn something about, you know, JFK, who's probably the most comfortable president around gay people, and there are interesting reasons for that, right? So for me, just trying to take this massive subject that had so many different angles, I wanted to impose some kind of organization on it. So as a writer, it just made it easier to say, you know, just to have my note, you know, have my folders of all my notes, you know, everything that's happening in the FDR era, it goes into that folder, right? Everything under Nixon goes into that folder. And so it just, it made it easier to organize the writing of it. And I hope for readers, it makes it a little easier to read. And that's
I think it does, because I think you're so right that people form impressions about American history through the lens of presidents. And it's also a really helpful way of reminding the reader, okay, FDR, this is quite some time ago, and you walk into it thinking, all right, I have a sense of what the mores and the traditions may have been. And you actually upend a lot of that. It's surprising in some cases how permissive, if I can use that word, or tolerant, which is, like I said, was a loaded word too, some of these organizations were. But like even thinking about the evolution of gay marriage, I mean, I think so many people go to Obama saying, I've evolved on the issue, right? I mean, presidents become sort of very, like, they're sort of bookmarks for us in places where we kind of, you know, say this is how we've progressed along the spectrum of any number of issues. So I think that that works really well. So let's get into some of these stories, because there are just, there are so many in here. And I mean, and there were people who I had never heard of. I mean, characters I have never encountered who were hugely consequential. And I'm thinking like, okay, this person needs to be a movie. That guy needs to be a TV series. That guy needs a book of his own. But let's start with FDR. Let's do this chronologically. And here, maybe let's start first with more, less a person than an idea. You have this chapter in the FDR Act called Patriotic Homosexuals, which I have to admit, when I started reading it, I was like, I'm not sure where he's going with this. And so it was not what I expected. So what is the concept of a patriotic homosexual, and how did the government envision using them?
So I came across this memo that was circulating among officers of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor to the CIA.
Right.
And a proposal had been made to them by a research institute called the Center for the Study of Sexual Variants. And they basically studied homosexuals. They interviewed them and whatnot. This was back when, you know, homosexuality was deemed a mental illness and gays were seen as a social problem, right? And this organization was actually quite enlightened for its time, and they were studying sexual variants. And one of the members of this organization wrote a letter basically suggesting, you know, because there are so many homosexuals in the Nazi party, which is a whole other story we can get into, was this this real serious belief that the Nazi hierarchy was just riddled with homosexuals. And this is sort of a cultural, you know, I think today actually there's still a, I mean, you look at the movie or the musical, the producers, you know, with Springtime for Hitler. I mean, this is like a real strong cultural association we have between homosexuality and fascism.
Right.
And we might kind of joke about it, you know, like in the producers, but this was actually something seriously believed. And the OSS commissioned two psychological studies of Adolf Hitler by Harvard psychiatrists, in which they actually go on at length about this belief that maybe Hitler is a repressed homosexual, that he's surrounded by homosexuals, that homosexuals are more likely to support a revolutionary movement because they have less to lose, or less to live for, basically. They can take a risk. Anyway, so this pitch was made to the OSS that they should seriously consider recruiting patriotic homosexuals, right, who can't serve in the military, because this is when the formal ban on gay military service begins, starts with World War II. It was actually not used that much because they just needed every warm body they could get in the military. So lots of gay people served in the military. And in fact, World War II was a major moment in gay American history, in that it sort of was, for the first time, it was when a lot of gay people realized, oh, wow, like there are other gay people like me. I'm not just alone in this. So this proposal was made to the America's first civilian intelligence agency. It didn't really go anywhere, or there's no evidence that it really went anywhere, but I kind of have the paper trail, and it's interesting to see the kind of back and forth among these officials where they're actually taking this into consideration. And there were, I do write later in that chapter, I do write about some gay spies in the OSS. And there's one particularly fascinating guy named Donald Downes, who was a Yale graduate. And
we'll get to him.
Okay, yeah.
But the idea here was that they were going to use them like to infiltrate organizations, right? I mean, they were going to – and was it – should we think of that as the way we think of like honeypots, in the sense that they're trying to sexually entrap potential intelligence targets?
I think that's one of the ideas. But really what's interesting, and you see this repeatedly in the book, is this understanding – that homosexuality exists in every social strata, right? That there are wealthy gays, there are poor gays, there are gays in Germany, there are gays in America, and that therefore gays can be very useful in sort of infiltrating all different sorts of social milieu. And this comes up repeatedly in sort of writings about homosexuality when it's still kind of this mystery. But yes, that seemed to be the idea that that the Nazis in particular were sexually degenerate, and therefore we can use our own sexual degenerates for patriotic purposes.
And there's also this sense, it seems, in some of these organizations that there is just kind of a gay network of people, of these like-minded people who themselves are kind of their own little intelligence apparatus. And you have a quote that I loved reflecting on this from somebody from the Times saying, "We had recently learned that there was a homosexual underground through which information traveled even more rapidly than by the channels of the Catholic Church and various Jewish organizations." Which is itself a rather problematic statement.
Well, no, this is this is in reference to, this is when World War II is going on.
So she's
referring to the kind of the Jewish relief agencies that were sending
were
sending messages about the Holocaust, the impending Holocaust, back through to the West. And they had a very good, had a very good network. And obviously the Catholic Church has its own network, right? There's parishes and priests all over Europe. And so she was actually comparing kind of the sort of gay grapevine, if you will.
To these
actually really impressive informational networks of the Jewish relief agencies in the Catholic Church.
Which is so interesting because I think, I mean, you know, there's, I mean, you know, it's often referred to there being like, you know, a gay mafia in D.C.
Right.
And maybe that's overstated, but obviously gay people socialize with one another and they have their own networks. But it's fascinating to me the way that this burgeoning intelligence organization identified this group of people as a networked kind of entity and said, like, yeah, maybe we should tap into that. And the OSS, as you write in the book, was actually remarkably tolerant of homosexuals. It did not. It's, I guess it's not how we would think of being a 1940s organization and how they reacted to gay people.
I mean, it's not like they were flying rainbow flags.
We
do know of the presence of a relative handful of gay people, and that really had to do, I think, with sort of this wartime ethos, particularly that, you know, Wild Bill Donovan, as he was named, who was the founder of the OSS. He had this sort of spaghetti on the wall, you know, approach where we're going to hire communists. We're going to hire, you know, anyone to fight Nazi Germany. And if there's a couple homosexuals in the bunch, then, you know, whatever, all for the,
it doesn't matter. It's not important to them. Right. Yeah. And you have a line too, where you're writing about the OSS and talking about how, the reason for the tolerance, albeit brief in duration and limited in scope, was pragmatic, as gays were seen to possess qualities beneficial for espionage, which we just talked about. And then this line, for the homosexual in mid-20th century America, deception and keeping secrets were matters of basic survival.
Yeah.
And that really is a theme running through the whole book, is that gay people had to learn to keep secrets. And in Washington, secrecy was power, and which is not to say that it was the same kind of secrets they were keeping, but this notion of power and imbalance of power plays so interestingly when you're talking about gay people who themselves have to learn how to live double lives.
Right. And you would think that this would make them, or you would think that this would make the government perhaps more receptive to the idea that maybe gay people could be better spies and maybe we should be recruiting them for this. And unfortunately, that's not what happens, obviously, after the war, certainly. And we can get into the purges that would follow. But
so you alluded to Donald Downs. Mm. So talk about Donald Downs. This is one of these people who jumps off the page and you think, my God, I mean, it's such a good story. But who was he?
So he was a Yale graduate, like many of the early generation of OSS. It was basically a Yale institution. And a private school teacher who basically found his way into the service of the OSS. Very patriotic, anti-Nazi figure. And his first job that I write about, really one of the first jobs the OSS did, was they had to penetrate the neutral embassies in the United States, primarily that of Spain. And he basically recruited all these handsome young men to basically go out and seduce the secretaries at the various neutral embassies. And
the female secretaries.
The female secretaries, yes, to get them, you know, to go on dates, to get information, to basically find their way in. And his reports that he wrote about the Spanish embassy are just, it's like great literature. He's describing the Francoist ambassador. And he says that he was more than merely homosexual. He had refinements of sexual mania, perverted with both sexes. And these were facts that were well known to his servants, to his associates, and to his wife. He threw these sort of bacchanals, these wild parties that were, quote, usually result in excesses, alcoholic and further. Guests, however, are hand-picked and hand-placed to excite romances among the various diplomatic corps that will give him an intimate insight to the private affairs of government circles. So just a real, you know, sounds like a wild time.
He's having like orgies and like, you know, and just building his network and getting information. Yeah. Right.
But they do actually are able to infiltrate the Spanish embassy, and they crack the safe that has the codes for the cryptographic messaging system and whatnot. And this actually leads to the first real spat between the intelligence community, what would become the CIA, and the FBI, which because the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, their turf is domestic, right? Domestic counter-espionage. And here you have the OSS, which is supposedly supposed to be doing, you know, foreign espionage. They're on the FBI's turf. And the FBI actually gets Downs's men arrested. And the next day, FDR has to call in Bill Donovan and Hoover into the Oval Office and basically, you know, yells at the two of them, what the hell's going on? You guys got to, you know, you got to figure this out. And as you know, the FBI and the CIA would have turf battles, you know, for decades, right? And you can kind of trace it back to Donald Downs stepping on J. Edgar Hoover's toes.
I love that. And I love that what ultimately the source of the turf battle is also, to some degree, an embarrassment of the FBI because the OSS is successful in this operation. Right. They figure out how to get in and pull it off. Yeah. Let's say a word about Hoover now, because I feel like whenever we talk about, you know, gay people in gay history, Hoover is kind of the 700-pound gorilla. you know, he is not as permissive and tolerant of gay people.
No.
But of course, Hoover also has the, I mean, if it's legend or not, I'll let you talk about this, that, you know, that he was gay, that his longtime assistant was his partner. I mean, accusations, he dressed in women's clothes. So talk a little bit about Hoover and how he sits in this history. I mean, he looms very large in it, but say a bit about him maybe even too in this era of FDR.
Well, it is sort of one of the great paradoxes of Washington, not just gay Washington, but Washington, that the man who was overseeing all these purges of gay people from the federal government and the collecting sexual secrets on other people was himself maybe a closeted homosexual. I have no evidence of this. No one does. Mm-hmm. You know, the story that you alluded to, the cross-dressing, which is funny, you know, I would tell people I was working on a book about gay Washington, and most often the reaction would be something along the lines of, oh, well, Hoover's got to be in there, and, you know, he was a cross-dresser, right? And that story,
Find His Dress, yeah.
Yeah, that story had originated in a biography written by a British journalist in 1993, which should immediately make you suspicious. If it's a British journalist, right? But he did, you know, he did the typical British journalist thing. He paid a widow of a mob boss who had dealings with Hoover, who basically told him this story that she was witness to J. Edgar Hoover, you know, in a dress, involved in like depraved sexual acts with young boys. That's the origins of this. And then it appears in the movie, J. Edgar, that Clint Eastwood directs. And it's widely believed, but it's almost certainly not true.
Yeah.
But it is a fascinating, bizarre aspect of all of this. One that, you know, here he is. He has this close relationship with Clyde Tolson, his associate director. They are eating lunch at the Mayflower Hotel every day. They go on vacations together. They're, you know, sitting at the racetrack together. Clearly people are, you know, whispering about this. And I write about it. That is from his very early days as director of the FBI, when it was still the Bureau of Investigation before it was formerly the FBI. You know, he's being written about in the popular press, all with these insinuations that they can't say it explicitly, but it's, he's walking with a slight mince in his step. Or, you know, certain items of clothes that he's wearing, or they refer to. One of the things I learned in this book was that a stereotypical gay male activity was antique collecting. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of, so they would say that he, you know, he enjoys collecting antiques. And that was sort of a wink and a nod.
A wink and a nod, yeah.
Right? So people are referring to it. But he was incredibly paranoid about this and very sensitive. And there's a part of the book, it's actually one of my favorite parts of the book, just recounting all the many times that, you know, if you mentioned to someone that J. Edgar Hoover was a homosexual, there was a not small chance that it would, that you might get visited by the FBI. Wow. And there are all these examples of, like, I start with these women playing bridge one day in Ohio, and one of them says that Hoover's a homosexual. It turns out one of the other ladies, her nephew, is an agent in the FBI. She tells her nephew, who then sends this up the line to the director. And like the next day, the woman who said this at the bridge party, she's being called into the St. Louis or Chicago, I forget which one, field office of the FBI and given a talking to by, you know, one of the special agents in charge, basically setting her straight, demanding to know where he heard this. Why would you say such a thing about the director? And she leaves terrified, and she says, not only am I apologizing to you, I'm going to tell all the women at our next weekly bridge party that it was, that I don't know what, I don't know where I got this from. It's completely wrong. And this would happen multiple times. There are all these reports of agents basically tracking down rumors of people, just random U.S. citizens exercising their free speech rights to gossip about our leaders, right? And they would basically read them the Riot Act. It's crazy when you think about it today, but it was.
And it really is like the stereotype of Hoover, right? Is this person who was thin-skinned, petty, had vendettas, and used information about people to try and ruin them,
right?
And you tell pretty compelling stories about that in the book too. Did you talk about a little bit about, you know, this is maybe trying to get inside his head and psychoanalyzing a bit, but like what is his aversion, at least as, you know, as it's expressed in his actions, to gay people? Why did he find them so threatening? And was that unusual?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he obviously had a particularly paranoid and vindictive aspect to his character in general. But the view that, you know, gay people were immoral, criminal, mentally ill, these were widely held views. These were not unusual views at all. They were held across the political spectrum. Liberals felt this way. Conservatives felt this way. There was pretty much a unanimity of opinion on this. And what's interesting is that the view that they are national security threats, that is what changes with America's, you know, rise to kind of global superpower status, right? So before World War II, all those negative attributes about gay people, those were widely held. Those were basically based on religious prejudice, you could say. But all that changes once America becomes... once it enters into World War II and it needs to start developing a bureaucratic apparatus for the collection and the maintenance of secret information. And then homosexuality goes from being a sin to a national security threat. And the fear is that gay people are more vulnerable to blackmail. Mm-hmm. And this I actually trace this back to go back to the espionage. I trace this back to a World War I era Austrian colonel named Colonel Alfred Radl, who's in the Austro-Hungarian, he's the head of the Austro-Hungarian counterintelligence service. And he is discovered in 1913, so around the eve of World War I, the Austro-Hungarian intelligence service, they discover that he is himself a spy for Imperial Russia. He happens to have been gay. There's no evidence, in fact, much evidence to the contrary, that his being gay had anything to do with it. He wasn't blackmailed. He was doing it for money, like a lot of spies do. But this was so embarrassing to the Austro-Hungarian intelligence service that their own counterintelligence director was himself a spy, that they basically promote this narrative that he was homosexual and he was blackmailed because of his homosexuality into working for the Russians. In this story, just takes on this like almost mythological status in the West among Western intelligence professionals. So Alan Dulles, who gets his start in the OSS, he's the first civilian director of the CIA. He writes about this in multiple books that he's published decades later. It's given in evidence in 1950, I believe. Yes, in 1950, the then director of the CIA, he's asked for, you know, can you point to any evidence that of gays being spies, being blackmailed? The one example he gives is Colonel Radl, which is, you know, from World War I, before World War I. So it just, you know, I'm sure if you were to interview, if there were still spies of that generation alive today, this is the sort of thing that they would talk about, right? The Radl case. We all know about that case. And then it turns out when they opened up the Russian archives after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they could actually look at his handler in the records, they didn't even know he was gay, the Russians, right? So this wasn't a part of the reason why he sold secrets, but it assumes this mythic status in the minds of our mid-century intelligence professionals.
And it just carries on for decades, right? Yeah. I mean, I had never heard Radl's story until I read it in your book. And, you know, my understanding, and two decades I've covered the intelligence community, when you talk to people about, you know, before there was an executive order to basically make it that being gay was not a reason that your security clearance could be revoked, it was just that it was common knowledge. Like, well, of course, you know, it was a problem being gay because you could be blackmailed, right? And it was just sort of assumed that was the reason. And then people would often say, and then, of course, now that we're more open and tolerant, the best thing is, of course, to come out because then they can't hold it out over you. So that kind of like mythology took on and just became sort of conventional wisdom, even though it's based in a story that's actually off base because the guy didn't become a spy because he was gay. He became a spy because he was, you know, greedy and acquisitive and to fund his lifestyle. But it's interesting too, the way that there are characters who show up in the story, you know, early on in the FDR era as well, you know, who were gay and didn't think it was a problem because they expressly said, like, well, there's nothing that I have nothing to hide. I couldn't be blackmailed. So that idea was already present back then as well.
Yeah.
Before gays became this sinister kind of menace.
Right. There's this great character, Carmel Offey.
That's where I was going to go next. Yeah. Who's
this fascinating. And he pops up, if you read some of the histories of the CIA, he pops up as kind of a figure in the background. And he starts off as a diplomat. Working for William Bullitt, the first ambassador to the Soviet Union. And he is basically described by everyone who knows him as this just sort of flamboyantly gay character. Mm-hmm. And it's very unusual because there weren't many people like this. And for whatever reason, he's sort of able to get away with it. I have to imagine he was very good at his job, right? And so William Bullitt, who's a character in the first couple chapters, basically protects him, you know, and Offey is involved in torpedoing the career of Sumner Wells, right? So he's a gay man, but he's using accusations of homosexuality against another gay man, which is something that unfortunately happens quite often in this book. I mean, the closet makes people do really terrible, awful things. But then after World War II, Offey is one of the founding fathers of the CIA. And he's he's working under diplomatic cover. He's part of the State Department, but he's really with the CIA, and he becomes really one of the first victims of the kind of bureaucratic war that goes on between the FBI and the CIA in the early years of the Cold War.
Yeah.
When McCarthy and Hoover and the FBI are basically accusing the CIA of harboring leftists and communists, which there were a lot of leftists and former communists in the OSS during World War II, because they were our allies. Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of them stayed on afterwards. And to Hoover, this is in McCarthy, this is obviously unthinkable that you could have anyone left of center, right, involved in the war against communism. And one of the weapons that they use are these accusations of homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And this also points to an interesting kind of cultural difference between the two institutions, and that the FBI was sort of the preserve of Catholic, heavily Catholic and sort of white ethnics, right? So we're talking Poles, Czechs, Central and Eastern Europeans, people of that ethnic background. It's a more culturally conservative institution. You know, J. Edgar Hoover makes everyone, they have to get a certain type of haircut. They have to wear a certain type of, suit and jacket and tie. I mean, it's a very regimental conservative culture. Blue collar or working class, middle class, working class, blue, more of a blue collar institution. Where the CIA is the preserve of WASPs, right? Very well educated, boarding school, private school. You could say they're more tolerant of eccentricities. Mm-hmm. Therefore more tolerant of homosexuality somewhat. Daniel Patrick Moynihan had a great line about in the age of the security clearance, it was the Harvard men who were checked and the Fordham men doing the checking, which really kind of describes the kind of, so it wasn't just turf battles that the FBI and the CIA were engaged in. It was a real different cultural attitude towards many different things, towards foreign policy, towards American society. These were very different institutions.
And secrecy permeates all of this. I mean, as you really, part of this book is such an interesting history of the intelligence community and the security state as something growing up in this kind of World War II and post-war era, where the ability to collect information is powerful, but the ability to keep it secret is, the need to keep it secret is important, and that people accrue power through secrecy, and that security clearance and background checks and these things that become integral to that architecture that is Washington, it is national power, this is the root, the era that it takes hold in.
Yeah, absolutely. And the ability to wield a security clearance or to take it back or to revoke it becomes extremely important. And in 1953, after basically running for office on one of their campaign planks was to clean out the homosexuals in Washington. The Republicans come into power in 1953 after that election. And one of the first executive orders that Eisenhower signs is 10450, which bars gay people from working for the federal government, but more importantly, at least in terms of this conversation, is it denies them security clearances, which basically makes it very difficult for any sort of, for a gay person to advance at all in this city.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
There's to spend a little moment, another moment on Carmel Offey. There's just, you open the chapter with this great kind of vivid image, and I'll just read it so people get a sense of him too. You start by saying, visiting a Moscow fur market, quote, as well-guarded as Fort Knox, C.L. Sulzberger, the chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times, was startled by what he saw, quote, imagine our astonishment when we were finally conducted into a large storeroom, and there, amid a pile of furs, only his head showing, the grinning Carmel Offey, Sulzberger recorded in a 1947 diary entry. Offey was acting as if he owned the place, quote, heaving pelts about and saying, I'll take this, not that, this, not that. What an operator. I still don't know how he got there. I mean, that guy is like the perfect intelligence officer. Yes. Like, how in the world did he get in there? And I mean, I think that this, I love that story because on the one hand, it is like this very vivid image of this like flamboyant kind of man, like going through fur pelts and whatever. And that's kind of funny and it's amusing and it fits with an image that we have of flamboyant people. But then there's the question like, no, how the hell did he get in there? How did you get into a Moscow fur market? And I think that it's such a, he's kind of this example of somebody who has this ability. I don't know if it's through charm or through his basic trade craft, but he is at the center of some of the more important intelligence operations of the early OSS and then into the post-war era. It's really, he's kind of a founding father of American intelligence.
Yeah, he is. And I say in the book that, you know, he probably deserves his own biography.
Yeah.
And I don't, that would be very hard to write because the documentary record just isn't there, but mm-hmm. no, he's a fascinating character. And you can read more about him in The Old Boys, which is a book I'd recommend by Burton Hirsch, which I don't know if you've read that, but it's one I would recommend. It's on the early founding of the CIA.
You talk about the record being thin, and I want to skip ahead actually, but I'll come back to some, go out of chronological order here. And to one of the stories I actually found one of the more tragic stories. And this gets to the question of, is the record thin because the record is just kind of erased of people? And it's the story of Arthur Vandenberg Jr., who is someone who, as you write, is basically relegated to a footnote in the annals of the history of Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower. Talk about who he was and why he is so barely remembered.
So he's the son of Arthur Vandenberg Sr., the senator from Michigan, who famously went from being an isolationist to being a supporter of American engagement abroad. His famous line that, you know, foreign policy should stop at the water's edge. His son, Art Jr., starts the Citizens for Eisenhower, which is basically the draft Eisenhower movement to get Eisenhower to run for the Republican nomination. So he's instrumental in Ike's election. And then after Ike's victory in 1952, he is preparing to be appointments secretary or secretary of the cabinet. This is not a job that exists anymore, but it's a very important job. It's not chief of staff, but it's basically running the cabinet.
Who gets which jobs? Yeah.
Yeah, a very important job. And in December of 1952, J. Edgar Hoover comes to meet with Ike at the transition headquarters in New York City and presents him with the evidence that he's gay, Art Jr.'s gay, and basically says to him, we won't investigate this further if he doesn't take this job. So it's basically a threat to Ike, you know, basically. And it's, you know, this is, you want to talk about how secrets and are used, you know, not only to just sort of destroy an individual's life, but imagine what Eisenhower is thinking sitting in that first meeting as in the incoming president with J. Edgar Hoover. And he's basically, you know, he's telling him who's boss in a way, right? He's like, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to this guy. And then they drop him. He sort of goes on with this sort of public face that he's sick. He checks himself into a hospital. They tell the press that he's, you know, absent because of illness. But then finally in April, they announce that he won't be taking a job. And by that point, he's basically forgotten. So the media doesn't go in and investigate it. And he goes down to Florida to teach at the University of Miami. And he's kind of he's a ruined man. But then what really is awful is that in 1956, really out of nowhere, this magazine called Confidential Magazine, which was really sort of the first supermarket tabloid, the scandal magazines that started in the 1950s, this was the leading one. It was widely read, millions of subscribers. Really out of nowhere, it outs him. We don't have that term at that time, but it outs him in a really disparaging article. And it basically drives him into alcoholism, and he dies, basically drinks himself to death. And it's a real tragic story. And there are so many others like that one, countless stories that we'll never know.
Yeah.
This one we happen to know because we have the FBI records and he was publicly outed. And I tell other stories like that one, but it's very sad.
How much did you feel when you were, I presumed in many cases, discovering these people,
yeah,
you know, as you're doing the research, you know, probably hadn't heard of them. Did you feel that you were kind of restoring a reputation for them, or like, or maybe setting something right? I mean, I found myself having very emotional reactions to these stories as a reader, and imagined what it would have been like to be discovering them as a journalist, as an historian, and thinking, you know, I've got an opportunity here to tell someone's story in a way that was simply never told because they had such an unfortunate ending.
Yeah, I did. And I tried to be very sensitive about it because these are very personal stories. They're dealing with people's personal lives. Oftentimes there are sexual details involved, mm-hmm, in these stories. And I tried to be respectful, yes. And I did feel obviously a personal connection with these people, because if I had been born in this era, that would have been me, you know, yeah, or would have been. And I think anyone reading this book who's gay has to feel that reading about, yeah, these people. And it really makes you think, you know, how would I have behaved? Mm-hmm. What would I have done? It made me, mm-hmm, I can say on this issue of outing, it made me, I was already pretty anti-outing. I mean, there are, mm-hmm, rare circumstances in which I think outing is appropriate, but this book really made me, appreciates how difficult it was to be gay in this era, you know. Mm-hmm. And you might have seen, or your readers might have seen, the story about Ed Koch that the New York Times published a couple, yeah, weeks ago that posthumously outed him. And you know, when he was alive, he wasn't doing enough on AIDS, and he was, you know, Larry Kramer was his main antagonist. They lived in the same apartment building. And he would constantly attack Koch. They would gay bait him, basically accuse him of being gay, right? And I can understand, as a gay person, why you might feel angry at another gay person who has political power, who might not be doing enough, and the feeling that he's not doing enough because he doesn't want to be seen as gay, because he's in the closet and doesn't want to be exposed. At the same time, Ed Koch grew up under the specter of the Lavender Scare. You know, he grew up under a period when gay people were hounded out of the federal government. And let's just think, I mean, this is a man who represented Greenwich Village. He came from the site of the Stonewall Uprising. He came from probably the most pro-gay district in America. And yet he himself did not feel that he could come out of the closet. And you can say that that's not courageous or cowardly or whatever. My ultimate feeling or sentiment when I read about someone like that is sadness. Mm-hmm. I feel sad for that person. I feel terrible for that person. Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't want to go out and out them and attack them. The villain in this situation, and I think in the book itself, the villain is the closet,
yeah,
right? The villain isn't necessarily, I mean, J. Edgar Hoover is a villain, obviously. Roy Cohn is a villain. These kinds of, you know, these closeted anti-gay Republicans, they're all kind of villainous in some way. But the real villain, the real overarching villain, is the closet. It's the societal paranoia or fear that our society used to have around gay people that caused people to behave this way. So,
I mean, from the first words of your book, I think you actually capture this so well, and I was really moved by your dedication. You write, "For my family and for all those who unburdened themselves of their secret so that I did not have to live with mine."
Yeah.
And, you know, I think any gay person reads that and they get a little bit of a lump in their throat, mm-hmm, because you understand all of the sacrifices and all of the suffering that people had to go through to get us to this point. And right. I mean, I don't know how you feel. I mean, I moved to DC in the late 1990s, and I was not yet out, but I came out not long after that. But the world was changing very quickly, and, you know, it was clear that it was a safer place to be out than it was before. And I remember as a young person learning about Larry Kramer and Frank Kameny and all these people, and kind, yeah, of looking around at my generation and being like, we have no idea, yeah, what these people went, exactly, through, and like kids today, you know,
right,
what I mean?
Right.
You find yourself, yeah, frustrated with them too?
Yeah. No, and I felt a responsibility doing this. And I say this in the introduction, but, you know, gayness is not a heritable trait, right? So every gay generation is born afresh. and you don't have a relative or a family in the same way that a Jewish person or an African American or an Irish American, that's how the, you know, your kind of cultural history is passed down at the dinner table, right? Through your older generations, your grandparents. Gay people don't have that. Right. They have to discover this all for themselves. And so that, I think you asked me, you know, why did I write this book? That was a large part of it, was because I felt like I don't know the history of like my people, you know, in the same way that I do, say, you know, I'm Jewish, right? So the same way I know about Jewish traditions and Jewish history and whatnot. So I think that's, I felt a real sort of duty in doing this to the kind of generations that came before.
Was Larry Kramer someone who helped you understand your gay story?
He did. And it's actually one of my great regrets, professional regrets, that he is no longer with us, because I think he really would have loved this book, or I would have loved to have known what he thought about it. I think he would have loved the book. And yeah, he totally inspired me. I mean, Larry could be, let's just say, not the most exact person in his writing about history.
Yeah.
You know, he ended up writing at the end of his life this two-part novel called The American People, in which he basically, you know, everyone is gay in this book. You know, George Washington is gay, Alexander Hamilton is gay, everyone is gay in this book. And I think he did that because he knew that, you know, he wasn't a historian, he was more of a novelist, right? And so he could kind of get away with doing it that way. But I think what I learned from him was the importance of homosexuality as an idea, as a phenomenon in history. I think that's something that he understood, that's something that he imparted to me. And I think that's really what I think the book is about, is basically saying, look, there's this thing called homosexuality, and it's more than just, you know, your neighbors, Bob and Steve, who are married. It has all these cultural and political implications to it, and how our society has viewed it and dealt with it, and it's been used to explain certain phenomena, other phenomena. It ties into all of our presidents and their administrations. And it has this kind of profound social significance. And that's what I was trying to convey in this book.
That absolutely comes across. And you know, it makes me think, as we're talking about one of my, I will say, regrets, I think, is, you know, when I moved to DC in the late 90s, you know, DuPont Circle and quickly Logan Circle were still sort of gay meccas of the city. You know, there were gay bars, there were gay neighborhoods. I mean, we talked about the gayborhood. And as a young gay man, having kind of finding my tribe and learning about that culture and being steeped in it and seeing how it was both integrated into the city but distinct from it as well, was tremendous and liberating and great fun. And I feel like I look around DC now, and you live here too, and I'm like, there is no gay neighborhood anymore.
Yeah.
Everybody, it's all integrated. And on the one hand, I think, oh, that's wonderful. That's a sign of progress. And, you know, straight people hang out in gay bars, and there really is. I mean, there are gay bars, but they're not exclusively gay anymore. But there's something that I miss as well. And I kind of missed a little bit of the ghettoization of it. And it's not because I want gay people to be separate, or right, because I want them to not be, you know, obviously I want us all to have rights and be included, but there's something special that I feel kind of gets lost. I don't know. Do you feel that way?
I do. And one of the funny moments in the book is I'm writing about the 1970s, which were a really important decade. I mean, they're all important decades, but it was significant in that that was really when sort of gay people were coming out of the closet, and the kind of Berlin Wall that separated gay and straight society starts to kind of crack. And this is the rise of, they called super bars. There were these gay discos in Southeast DC. And they were so popular that straight people wanted to go to them.
Yeah, like tracks and other places.
And straight people wanted to go to them. And this is, you know, you started having gay, there's a story in the Washington Post with one of the owners of one of these bars basically complaining about, you know, all these straight people that are taking up all the room at our bars. And you hear this a lot now, but like to actually go back and see when that complaint began, because now, you know, it's like all the gay bars, it's all like bachelorette parties and whatnot. And there's some gay bars that are, you'd think that they're basically straight bars at this point. It's almost become kind of a trope, right? Of kind of complaining about that, but to actually see when it started, like in the mid 70s, that was amusing.
And it's such an interesting, maybe unexpected thing for some people, and maybe for straight people too, is that because so much of the gay civil rights movement is built on tearing down those walls, but there is still a desire to keep some of them up. And I mean, it's not that hard to think about. People do like to sort of associate with their tribe. But the secrecy aspect, of course, is gone when you're in a gay bar. And I mean, and it's one of the things that I find so remarkable about living in Washington is it was still kind of a little bit novel to be out in the workplace when I got here, but just a little bit, like at the very tail end of it. And now it's just like, you know, I don't feel remotely unusual at all. I mean, I refer to my husband, everyone knows him. It's not, being gay is no longer, it doesn't feel like it has, at least in Washington, it doesn't feel like it has that same risk that it once did, which into the core themes of your book, that paranoia around gay people in the security apparatus is, I don't think it exists anymore. I mean, it would be bizarre.
No, it doesn't. And I think that sort of felt like now is the right time to write this book, because I feel like I'm closing a chapter on gay history in the book. So it starts with FDR and it ends with Bill Clinton lifting the ban on security clearances in 95, which is not to say that there wasn't gay history being made after that. Clearly there was.
Yeah,
but it had more to do with the civil rights aspects of the gay rights movement, which is not really what my book is about. My book is about this issue of secrecy in the nation's capital, right? And so I think the kind of bookends for that are, you know, World War II until the end of the Cold War.
Let's jump in our time we have left here with one more famous case, which listeners will, I'm sure, know tons about, and there's been so much written about it, which is the Hiss Chambers affair. So start by just reminding people who the thumbnail of what that was all about, and then let's get into how the secret gay life or not gay life informs that story.
So Whitaker Chambers was a senior editor at Time Magazine, a very well-known, I wouldn't say, he was a very erudite and quite well-known journalist, conservative journalist. And in 1948, he makes a shocking claim that he had been a messenger in the communist underground in the 1930s, and that Alger Hiss, who was a high-ranking State Department official, he was the U.S. delegate to the first meeting of the United Nations in San Francisco, that he had been a communist spy. And this is the trial of the century, right? I mean, there have been many trials of the century since, but this is sort of was known for that era as the trial of the century. And it becomes a national saga. And Hiss is associated with all the great progressive figures of the era. He had been a clerk to Oliver Wendell Holmes, Harvard educated, just, you know, the kind of paragon of Eastern establishment correctness and refinement, right? Mm-hmm. And Chambers is this kind of sloppily dressed, overweight guy with bad teeth. He's a former communist. He seems untrustworthy. And sort of underneath the official story that everyone's talking about, this very dramatic spy drama, is this suspicion that perhaps the two men had been gay lovers. And the origins of this are the fact that, you know, Chambers had a gay past. He confessed it to the FBI because he was afraid that the Hiss forces might use this against him during their confrontation. And it's never publicly mentioned at the time. Again, just to show you the extent to which this was such a taboo subject. So no one actually ever, you know, openly uses the word homosexual. Hiss uses the word queer several times to describe Chambers, which had a different meaning in 1948 than it does today. So these sort of hints and insinuations. And then during Hiss's perjury trial, there are two perjury trials because the statute of limitations on espionage had expired, but he was tried for perjury. They basically accused Chambers of being mentally insane. So that's the kind of defense strategy. And they were considering accusing him of being a spurned homosexual. And they basically start a whisper campaign against him. But they decide not to in the end because there's a real fear that if you know, if they expose or if they accuse Chambers of being homosexual, it'll boomerang back on Hiss. That even though Hiss is not gay, there's no evidence that he was, just the mere inclination or the mere inkling that he might be would be so damaging that, you know what, it's just not worth the risk. It's not worth doing. And it's fascinating because Richard Nixon, this is his real first emergence on the national political scene. He's a young congressman from California who's on the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he champions Chambers. And decades later, Nixon believes that the two of them are lovers, actually. He's one of the few people who believes that they're both lovers and that Hiss is guilty. But he believes this, and it kind of obsesses him as president when they're trying to go after Daniel Ellsberg, the leaker of the Pentagon Papers. Nixon has it in his mind that Ellsberg must be a homosexual, and that if we can only get this information, if we can only get the proof that he's a homosexual, we'll be able to destroy him, which is what prompts him to get the plumbers to go break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. Later, when there's a leak of information from his administration to a newspaper columnist, he's convinced that the leaker and the newspaper columnist are gay lovers, that there's no other explanation for how these two people could know each other. It turns out they were members of the same church. But it just it
kind not of, what he thought.
Yeah, it just shows you that because of the secrecy that surrounded it, that homosexuality was something that people would reach to explain things, right? So we don't really get what's going on here between Hiss and Chambers. It's really mysterious. Maybe they're gay lovers. And I actually didn't know this until recently. I was watching the movie Richard Jewell about the man who the security guard at the Atlanta Olympics in 1996, who was falsely accused of planting a bomb. And at one point, the FBI developed a theory that he and his best friend, because they were communicating a lot, I think by phone, that they were gay lovers and accomplices, right? Because they couldn't understand why he was calling this guy so much, who happened to be his best friend. It had to have been some kind of nefarious gay angle to it. And, you know, even today, I think, you know, with this kind of rhetoric about groomers that we're seeing a lot in public debate, right? It's this sort of echoing, this kind of recurring obsession or paranoia around homosexuality is a sort of dark force that's lurking in the shadows. That's a theme of the book, too.
How much do you think, too, because clearly there's this kind of paranoia about fear and fear about homosexuality as this sinister force that is independent of, you know, the national security state, because you see it popping up in so many contexts. But the national security apparatus and the culture of it is deeply paranoid. I mean, in some ways, for good reason. You think spies are being run against you. But here, I wonder how much you came away thinking that the kind of the paranoia that exists in many contexts around gay people is something that kind of rubbed off specifically on the security culture and fueled its paranoia, or even was responsible for much of it? Or is it just that, or are those two not necessarily connected?
You know, that's an interesting question you ask, and it's not something I've considered. It's something I should consider. It sounds like something you might want to write about, Shane, because you know a lot more. You know a lot more about that than I do.
Fear of gay people is what created paranoia in the intelligence community. But Jesus Angleton.
But I do think a lot of the paranoia about communists in the 1950s, it had a lot to do, and it was often conflated with a kind of sex panic. And that communists and homosexuals, you know, the homosexuals were sexual deviants, and therefore they were political deviants. And that there was this connection from one to the other. In the language that they would use to describe communists was sometimes sexual in nature, that they were, you know, penetrating society, or the use of the word deviant. Mm-hmm. You know, political deviance, sexual deviance. There's a lot of correlation between these two themes and fears.
Right.
And again, just, you know, it's ironic, right, that someone like Hoover himself might have been a sexual deviant, right?
Yeah.
Even though he's the most upstanding, uptight guy in Washington who's at war against these forces, may have himself been one.
And he's buried next to Clive Tolson, isn't he?
Yeah, it's one of the funny, well, funny. I end the book on this because it's sort of heartwarming. But yes, Tolson is buried like 20 feet from Hoover at Congressional Cemetery. And in the 1980s, a man named Leonard Matlevich, who was the first gay soldier to challenge the ban on gays in the military in 1975, he died of AIDS, and he decided that he wanted to be buried. He wanted to start basically a he wanted to create a monument for gay people to honor their ancestors, right? So he wanted a corner of Congressional Cemetery to basically become this gay corner. So he gets a plot as close as he can to J. Edgar Hoover. And he has a very famous headstone. It says, "I was given two purple hearts for killing a man and a discharge for loving one." It's a very moving.
It's great, yeah.
A very moving headstone. But then after he dies, all these other gay people start buying up plots in Congressional Cemetery near Matlevich's headstone and J. Edgar Hoover. So J. Edgar, if you go there today, the Congressional Cemetery, you will see all these gay people's burial plots, and there are rainbow flags, and there are couples buried next to each other. And it's kind of a final, you know, fuck you to J. Edgar Hoover. It's very moving, actually.
Yeah, no, it is pretty great. And it's a, and I hope that young gay people especially will go there and will see that and read your book, obviously, too. So it is our tradition on Chatter that the very last question of our interview is I reach into the Chatter box, which I have right here in front of me, and I am going to select at random a previously written question.
Okay.
Which may or may not involve homosexuals or
demons. Oh, interesting.
We'll see. We'll see. Let's see how this is. Oh, this has absolutely nothing to do with the subject of your book. But you being someone who has written a lot about foreign policy, you've written a lot about Russia, you've written a lot about superpower politics, this is a good one. Should we ban all nuclear weapons?
Ban nuclear weapons? Well, we've tried to ban nuclear weapons, and I feel like it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure it would be a good thing either, to be honest. I think, there are international relations theorists who have argued that the fact that the Soviet Union and the United States were nuclear armed powers meant that they did not get into a conventional war. There were obviously lots of other conventional wars during the Cold War, all sorts of proxy wars and whatnot. But had there not been this threat of global destruction, then perhaps there would have been massive bloodshed through a conventional war, like we saw in World War II, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not even sure that even if we had the power to just wave a magic wand and remove all nuclear weapons, I'm not sure it would necessarily be a good thing.
I'll ask one more question. Yeah. You've reported a lot on Russia. Memorably protested in front of RT, which was great. People can go look that up online. Do you worry that Vladimir Putin would actually use a nuclear weapon in this conflict? I mean, or maybe even like if that's too big of a question, when you're thinking about like how far would he go in the current war? I mean, what is on your mind as you think about that?
You know, I have to think that someone in the Russian command structure would prevent that from happening.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not an expert on the Russian nuclear command structure.
Right.
I've actually heard that they're quite conservative. There's some sort of connection between that and maybe the Russian Orthodox Church. It has its own sort of internal culture. Mm-hmm. And so they might even be to the right of Vladimir Putin or more nationalistic. I don't know. But my former colleague at Brookings, Fiona Hill, who probably knows more about Putin than anyone, she has said that she thinks that there are circumstances in which he might do that.
Yeah.
Which is enough to keep you up at night. So
the Cold War is back again, my friend. Yeah. It is really something. Well, Jamie Kirchick, thank you.
Thank you.
Great to see this book in the world. I know how hard you worked on it, and you've always been such a superb journalist and chronicler and writer and observer. People should go get Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. It is a big book. I promise you it is highly readable. It is compulsive in some parts in terms of how wonderful it is to read. These are great stories, and it's an important one. So thank you for writing the book, and thank you for coming on to talk about it.
Thank you for that endorsement. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.